Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The best of Larry Kudlow is on the air. 77 WABC.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It is great to be with you as always. And by the way, you can join us during the week on Fox Business. Name of the show is Kudlow. 4 to 5 p.m. every day, Monday through Friday. And if by some crazy chance you can't make it at 4, you can text your favorite 9-year-old and she'll show you how to DVR the show, or the show plays again 7 to 8 p.m. And here on radio, you can live stream us on the internet. LarryKudlowShow.com, LarryKudlowShow.com. You can hear us all across the country, around the world, throughout the solar system, and the Milky Way, so you can't miss us. Anyway, great to be with you. A couple things I want to talk about. Politics, number one, the Republican debate Wednesday night. Mr. Trump didn't show up. He was probably the real winner. I want to say, we're going to talk about this with John Carney of Breitbart and Mark Simone, radio host, at the half hour. But I'm going to say right at the top, I don't think they got the job done. I mean, I know there's a lot of, you know, polling and punditry about the individual candidates, but the overall message, I don't think, was very strong. I didn't hear anybody really beat Joe Biden, which is a big problem, because we've got to stop his big government socialism and his crazy climate change and woke policies, etc., etc. I mean, I think some of those guys had great moments. I think the winner of the debate was Vivek Ramaswamy, businessman, young businessman, successful entrepreneur. He defended Donald Trump and really was probably the biggest supporter of Trump policies, including the Ukraine war, which is splitting the Republican Party in two. Vivek wants to take the Trump view, which is to make a peace deal as soon as possible, whereas Mike Pence, my pal Mike Pence, and Nikki Haley, former U.N. ambassador, want to continue the war until Ukraine wins, which I think is not likely. But in any event, my sort of 50,000-foot view is that nobody had a strong growth message. Nobody had a very positive economic message. Nobody had a MAGA message, Make America Great Again. They were kind of sniping at each other. Nobody really took on Bidenomics. And John Carney of Breitbart wrote a very good piece about how they really didn't tackle inflation. In the economy, inflation is the number one. It's the number one issue. Everybody says that. All the polls show that. I mean, they didn't talk about middle-class affordability, you know, the high price of basic necessities like groceries or gasoline. You know, gasoline's, I don't know what it is today, it's about $3.85. When Biden took office, it was about $2.30. Now, it may be down from its peak, which was around $5, but it's still very high. In fact, all prices, this is a problem. You know, the year-to-year change in the Consumer Price Index has come down from over 9% to 3.2%. The core rate is 4.7%, I think, or 4.8%. But the level of prices is 16% higher than it was back in early 2021 when Biden took office. And that high level of prices, whether it's groceries that are up 20% or gasoline that's up $1.50, that's cutting into middle class affordability. And the estimates are $700 a month. It's $700 a month more expensive to live than it was 2.5 years ago. Nobody mentioned that. I don't recall anybody mentioning that. And I don't recall anybody really talking about this inflation problem. Affordability. And then I don't recall anybody talking about the inflation decline in wages. Real wages are down substantially over the last 2.5 years. So you're working hard. You have a job. That's good. The unemployment rate is low. That's good. But because of high prices of necessities of life, as I say, like gasoline or food, just two things, gasoline and groceries, just like that, bang, bang. It's a lot of other stuff, too, but just those two, think of it. Because of that high prices, the wages have gone down. What you earn buys less. Your take-home pay is falling. After taxes and after inflation, your take-home pay is falling under Biden for well over 2 years. And that's why his economic approval rating is about 35%. I didn't see anybody really tackle that. Now, there were good moments. I mean, I'm not going to trash the whole thing. There were good moments. All right, Mike Pence, for example, talked about the Trump-Pence, as he calls it, the Trump-Pence tax cuts, which were enormously successful in boosting the economy, where middle and lower income people had the greatest gains in wages, $6,000 increase in wages, whereas wages are falling right now, as I said before. So Mike Pence mentioned that. That was good. Nobody, as far as I know, nobody mentioned the tax cuts. Nobody else. And, of course, as I said, I didn't hear anybody mention the inflation problem, the wage problem, the cost of living problem, the affordability problem. These are big issues, folks. You're not going to beat Joe Biden unless you tackle these issues. And that's what's on Americans' minds. And I didn't hear that. As I said, I didn't really hear a positive, optimistic message. You know, my pal, the great Art Laffer, Arthur Laffer, has said time and time again on the TV show and on this radio show, he said, Republicans need to show the public, I don't care who you are, men, women, suburbs, cities, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, anybody, the Republicans have to show the public that they will be stewards of a prosperous economy. Except for a couple years under Trump, 2018, 2019, after the tax cuts, and a couple years under George W. Bush, after his tax cuts of 2003. Except for a couple years, we have not had a prosperity-driven economy. We have not. It's almost 25 years, 23 years. Spanning Bush, Obama, Trump, and now Biden. Americans yearn for us. We need like a Reagan's economy. Reagan cut taxes, Reagan cut regulations. Reagan was in favor of free market capitalism. Reagan was pro-business. The economy grew about 5.5% at an annual rate from 1982 through 1990. 8 years. 8 years. You want to go way back, to the John F. Kennedy tax cuts in the 1960s. The economy grew at about 5%, I think over 5% under JFK. That's prosperity. For the last 20 years, 23 years, we've grown less than 2% per year. The last, Joe Biden's first full year in office, 2022, and this year, 2023, the economy has grown at 1.3% at an annual rate. That's not 5. That's less than 2. That's the kind of thing you need to talk about. And then bring it back to the pocketbook issues, the kitchen table issues of take-home pay, of the prices of ordinary, you know, necessities of life. Kitchen table issues, pocketbook issues. They didn't do that. Now, Ramaswamy was good. He talked about climate change and bashed it as a hoax, and he's right. You've got Nobel Prize winners talking about the hoax of climate change. There's no existential risk whatsoever. He did the best job. I thought he had a good, we had him on the TV show, and his nuclear family, traditional nuclear family, was also a good message. So he had a good message. I mean, I thought DeSantis was, you know, good on education and good on crime, firing some U.S. attorneys. So some of these guys had, you know, they had moments. But no one had the overarching, what I call the MAGA issue, the way Donald Trump has the MAGA issue. Make America great again. Here's my vision. Here's my positive, optimistic vision of the future. We're going to cut taxes, cut regulations, reopen the spigots for oil and gas. That's a message. We're going to raise real wages the way we did before. That's a message. I didn't hear that. Bidenomics has failed. Big government planning, big government socialism, big government spending, along with the taxing and regulating and the crazy obsessive climate change. I just didn't hear that message with any clarity. And Ramaswamy won the debate, but the guy who really won the debate was Donald Trump. He won the debate. And Trump finds himself now with a huge lead. He was talking to Tucker Carlson. A lot of people heard him. Latest poll, interactive polls, post-debate, Trump 61%, DeSantis 9, Ramaswamy 5, Pence 5, Tim Scott 3, Haley 2, Christie 1. Trump holds a 52-point lead. This is a post-debate poll, and it's a good one. So what does that tell you? Trump has the message, and he has the experience, and no matter what the Biden Justice Department tries to do to him, he's still the front runner in the GOP, and he's running even or ahead of Biden in the presidential race. So think about that. All right, we're going to take a break. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to talk some more about this. This Trump mugshot story is just the most dreadful story. What is America doing to itself? The most dreadful story. Quick break. I'm Kudlow. Right back after this.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. The best of Larry Kudlow is on the air. 77 WABC.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. You know, it's there's a story in the Washington Examiner how Republicans, I guess on the Small Business Committee, in the House. So they run the House, so they run the committee. Anyhow, the Energy Department, Jennifer Granholm, has now put out a new regulation. You can't have ceiling fans. Now you have to have different ceiling fans. Now, here's the thing. This is something that Republicans should have talked about in the debate, because there's a lot of appliances. Trump talks about this all the time. When I interviewed Trump last week, we had a whole section. He just started talking about this. Water pressure, toilets, showers, shower heads. You go down the list, of course, gas stoves, microwaves, all these things, heaters, gas heaters, all these appliances that people own and like and use at home or in their business are being thrown out by these crazy Biden regulations, all in the name of climate change, which itself is crazy. It's a hoax. It is a hoax. There's no threat. Carbon emissions are falling, mostly because of natural gas and better technologies. Anyway, I digress, because people now, these ceiling fans, so that the argument, 10 to 30% of small businesses who make ceiling fans are going to be thrown out of business. All right? So call 20% of those. I mean, this is something that they make. Manufacturers, they make them in the Midwest, they make them in the South. Businesses use fans, people at home use fans. Now the Energy Department, Jennifer Granholm, and the Biden administration says you can't use that. You can't have these fans. Okay, that's just nonsense, utter nonsense. Has no impact on climate change whatsoever. None. Zero. And that's the kind of thing people should be talking about, people, Republicans. And, of course, no gas-powered cars. No gas-powered cars. There's a story in New Jersey, editorial in the Wall Street Journal. Governor Phil Murphy, nice guy, by the way, but he's wrong on so many issues. So then by 2035, no gas-powered cars. It's the California idea. They've done the same thing. A couple of wacko states on the West Coast, you know, Washington, Oregon, California. Crazy. Crazy stuff. Anyhow, no gas-powered cars by 2035, but I think there's a loophole. You can have used cars, used gas-powered cars. So what's that going to do to the car business? Going to kill it. Going to kill it. They can't make cars because people don't want the electric vehicles, and they can't make new gas cars, but you can have old ones. I mean, this is just insanity. And it, you know what? It lacks ordinary common sense. People scratch their head. You don't have to be a PhD to figure this stuff out. That's what the GOP's got to do to win the election in 24. Donald Trump does that. He knows this story cold. The others have not. It's a pity, because there's good people. I'm not here to damage them. I'm just saying they didn't get the job done. I'm Kudlow. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to continue our discussion of the debate and other related matters, including the mugshot story. Anyway, this is going to be great fun. This is a brand new duo, very exciting. John Carney, Breitbart News editor, economics and finance, co-author of the Breitbart Business Digest, and my dear friend Mark Simone, radio host, 710 WOR, weekdays, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., recently nominated to the Radio Hall of Fame. Gentlemen, thank you very much for doing this. John Carney, I got to start with you. You wrote the greatest piece. This is, do you have a Hall of Fame articles list? This is so great. Business Digest, out on Thursday. Americans wanted to hear about inflation, but the Republicans didn't talk about it. I just mentioned it in my opening riff, and I also mentioned it on the TV show Thursday. John Stuart Mill once called the Conservative Party in England the stupidest party, and by inference, the Republicans. The number one issue is inflation. There was almost no discussion about it. I just talked about it in my opening here, John. I don't think Mark Simone's going to disagree with that. And also, You're great. Thank you for this, by the way. Thank you very much. By contrast, our friend Larry Kudlow interviewed Donald Trump last week, and they spent nearly an hour talking about the economy. Trump provided very detailed discussions of a number of issues, including trade, tariffs, and the importance of American inflation. Kudlow began his interview by focusing on inflation. Okay, and Trump talked about inflation, et cetera, et cetera. And John, the GOP didn't talk about it in the debate. How is this possible? I mean, really? How are you going to beat Biden if you don't go after his greatest weakness?
It was incredible, Larry. I sat there, you know, getting ready for the debate with my notebook out to, you know, write down all of the great things I expected to hear from these guys who want to be president of the United States, who are running to be the Republican nominee to beat Biden. So I was ready to go. And at the end of the debate, I had nothing. I had a pen and a blank piece of paper. And that was, I couldn't believe that they blew this chance to, you know, explain how they would do things differently, why Biden, how Biden had contributed to this massive surge of inflation. We got nothing from them. And as you said, all of the polls show that this is Biden's key weakness, that this is the number one concern of all Americans, but also that by far the number one concern among Republicans, who these guys are running for their endorsement. So it was just an incredibly lost opportunity for these people.
And Mark Simone, I interviewed Trump a week before the debate, and that's all we talked about was the economy, inflation, as John pointed out, trade, tariffs, American manufacturing. That's, Federal Reserve policies. Now, I know, Mark Simone, you're not the economics guy, but don't you think this is an odd story?
Yeah, you know, and for people that say, why does he keep talking about 2020? Why does he keep talking about that? That's because you keep asking him about that. You asked him about the economy and inflation and got him to open up for 1 hour. And he's got, he knows what to do. He's got great depth on the issue. Now, these guys in the debate, in their defense, they don't know anything about fighting inflation. DeSantis has been a great governor, but there's no indication he knows how to run a national economy. Hmm. Fighting inflation, Chris Christie has proven he knows nothing about it. Look what he did in New Jersey. So they were just busy trying to take out each other. They're concerned about themselves right now, not us yet.
So, Mark, Trump, this is you saw the interactive poll. Trump has a 52-point lead. This poll was taken after the debate. What does that tell you?
That he was right not to go to the debates. Why should he be sitting at the kiddie table? He'd look out of place there. This was a little junior varsity group. He's got the nomination. I mean, you know, anything can happen in a year. But as it stands now, he's got the nomination. These guys just have proven they're not ready for prime time. They're all running for something. Some are running for vice president. Vivek, I could see being a great cabinet member. Tim Scott, same thing. Christie was running for trying to get on a Friars roast or something. I don't know what he was trying to
That's great.
Now, Pence can't run for vice president. He already was vice president. I don't know what he was doing there.
Yeah, actually, John, Pence was the only guy that talked about tax cuts. He mentioned them. He said, we have to extend he called them the Trump-Pence tax cut. I thought that was odd, too. I mean, When you listen to Trump, now I had this in my interview, but look, Trump is running an issues campaign. He always talks about, you know, climate change, tax cuts, deregulation, inflation. That's all. He talks about it constantly. Every speech he gives, he's done these videos on these issues. He's put out white papers. Whether one likes Trump or not, my point is he's running a sharp-edged issues campaign, and the others just don't seem to get this, John Carney.
I think that's right. I think that they have focused on – look, I think all of the issues that they discuss, the cultural issues, social issues, are all very, very important. But the key weakness right now that Biden has is the economy. People are really unhappy with the economy. It's almost as if, Larry – Trump must have, sometime in the last decade, surrounded himself with some brilliant economic minds who really helped him learn about how this stuff works, because, you know, obviously he knows these issues very well, and I think he is the really showed that what the debate showed to me is none of these guys who are up on stage really have an idea about how the economy works, what can be done about it, what, you know, even if a guy said, well, look, you know, you can take the position that I don't think, you know, that it's all up to the Fed. Fine, take that position. Explain how you would advise the Fed to do something different. Trump wasn't shy during his administration about chastising the Fed. They freaked out about it. The left freaked out when he did it. But you can do that as president. They could at least explain how they would exhort the Fed to do a better job than it's done.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Mark Simone, let me go to this mugshot issue and get your take on it, because, this is a bad thing for this country to do, you know, to try to do to Trump what the Democrats are trying to do to Trump. And the mugshot issue in some ways encapsulate this whole issue. I mean, basically, the Biden Democrats want to throw Trump in jail. We know that. Of course, he could still run from jail. But the point is, this is so un-American. This is so against American interests. I mean, what does this look like if you're sitting there in Europe or Latin America or Asia or China and you see this stuff? I mean, how this just degrades the whole country, Mark Simone.
Yeah, you know, obviously the economy is the big issue. But number two is the complete loss of any law and order. I mean, we're in total chaos now. They've corrupted the Justice Department. They've corrupted law enforcement in our cities. The border's wide. This is a big, big issue. And that mugshot is going to be the biggest backfire in history. You know, one of Biden's big problems, he's lost younger voters. They're not taking to him. And a lot of analysts are now seeing this mugshot is helping Trump with younger voters. He now looks like the rebel. He now looks like the outsider. It gives him the swagger. Remember who had famous mugshots? Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Tupac Shakur, Johnny Cash. You become a folk hero, a real rebel, and he's going to probably pick up now with younger voters. They're now looking at him differently.
What is that? When you saw that mugshot, what was your feeling? I mean, it looks like he's very angry. He has a right to be angry.
He looks defiant to me, Larry, is what
defiant.
It's, and I think
right.
I think that's actually one of the things people love about Donald Trump. We were at Breitbart, we actually started selling T-shirts and coffee mugs with the mugshot on it. But even before we could get, you know, the mugshot came out and people were already searching for merchandise. They, you know, they wanted this mugshot. They wanted posters of it. They wanted coffee mugs. They wanted T-shirts. We couldn't make, you know, like get the companies to put it on there fast enough. And literally that, you know, people are buying these things because it's going to become a symbol of the symbol of Trump's defiance is going to become a symbol of the people's defiance as well.
You know, Mark Simone, that do you see it? I think Carney's right. I mean, he looked angry, yes, but defiant. I like that defiant. What do you think, Mark?
I know exactly what he was doing. Knowing this guy for decades, he practiced the mugshot. They took sample mugshots. He figured out exactly the look he wanted. He used that look a little in 2015 in some of the debates. Mm. That look is Clint Eastwood, is Dirty Harry, because he knows people are looking for that right now. That's what they want, a guy like that to come clean up this mess.
So you think this is going to backfire?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, Mark, you see this poll that Trump now has a 52-point lead? After the first debate, what does that tell you?
It tells me this is without even showing up. Could you imagine if he showed up, the lead he would have? Vivek was great, but, he's no match for Trump. Obviously, DeSantis has shown he hasn't got it as far as a campaigner. He's just awkward and dead. And Tim Scott, I love him. Great. I don't know if he's ready for prime time. But Trump, once he shows up in a debate, you'll see how much bigger than life he is among these guys.
Mark, DeSantis had trouble figuring out whether to raise his hand or not. Remember that?
Yeah, that is right out of the John Kerry school. Let's take a poll to see what I think.
Yeah, but he looked to the left, and he was kind of – he kept his hand. Then he looked to the right, and they were for Trump, and he started to raise his hand. You know, those visuals will kill you. I mean, those pictures worth 1,000 words.
George Bush wiped out Gore in his speech at the convention when he said, "I don't have to see which way the wind is blowing to know what I think or where it stands."
I mean, that is really, really something. John Carney, I know you're not that political, but you figure Trump's going to get the nomination.
Yeah, of course he's going to get the nomination. And look, as you were saying, the mugshot is going to, it's free advertising everywhere. The defiant look really captures the nation's mood. I agree with Mark, by the way. This thing, Trump makes sure he does things right. It's actually one of the things people like about him. He didn't just let them take a mugshot. He definitely had practice mugshots taken of him. And, as he would put it, this is a great mugshot. This is the perfect mugshot, right? It is absolutely perfect, just like all the phone calls. It's a perfect mugshot. And it is. Believe me. I mean, there's a reason why people want this stuff on T-shirts right now. They're going to wear them. We're going to see them.
Boy, it's really something. All right, let's take a quick break. John Carney of Breitbart, co-author of the Breitbart Business Digest. Folks, you have to – the Breitbart Business Digest comes out every day. It is an absolute must-read. And my great friend Mark Simone, radio host at 710 WOR. We're very open-minded here on the Kudlow Show. Mark is on weekdays 10 a.m. to 12 noon and recently nominated to the Radio Hall of Fame. He's the best of the best. I'm Kudlow, very humble. We'll be right back.
Larry Kudlow. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're here talking to John Carney of Breitbart, co-author of the Breitbart Business Digest, and Mark Simone, radio host at WOR 710 weekdays between 10 and noon every day. Mark Simone, you're not a big drinker. I haven't had a drink in 28 years, actually. Did it as a public service. But there's a new regulation coming out of the Biden administration. You could only have two drinks a week. Now,
what?
It just came out. It's actually, Gutfeld was talking about it last night on his show. I see some newspaper coverage, some media coverage this morning. Two drinks a week. Now, this is part, the reason I raise this is this is part of their central planning attempts to control everything. I mean, climate change is the biggest part of that. You can't have a gas-powered car in a couple of years. I want to get to the new appliances on no ceiling fans. But two drinks a week, Mark Simone, how do you think that's going to play?
Well, if I were in the bar business or restaurant business, I'd be very upset. Well, as I was saying before, obviously the economy is always, when it's bad, that's the big issue. But this police state stuff is going to become the big issue. It's just total lawlessness. It all ties together. They want to tell you what appliance, come right into your house, tell you what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, throw you in jail if you disagree. Hey, and there's a big breaking story this morning, New York Post reporting. Biden's White House counsel met with Jack Smith's office.
I know. I have to catch up on that story. I saw the headline. I got to read. So tell us more about that one.
It's all going to tie together. His White House counsel met with Jack Smith's team about 2 weeks before the indictment. This is, you're going to have the corruption investigation. This looks extremely corrupt to everybody. It's all going to tie together. And then that going after the appliances and making it into a police state. I don't think Biden's going to be the nominee. I think in early next year, he's going to announce he's not seeking reelection. They're going to pull him out and look for somebody else. Wow. He just looks too corrupt with all of this stuff tied together.
I want to know what kind of Jedi mind trick that the right has pulled on the Biden administration to make them oppose pizza, beer, ceiling fans, showers that work. Like, literally, we have them on the wrong side of everything. And yet they keep going. It keeps getting worse. You think, oh, well, they're banning coal fire and wood fire pizzas in New York City. That's really bad. And then they're like, oh, you think that's bad? We're also going to tell you you can't have more than two beers in a week. I mean,
if you're trying to win suburban housewives, you tell them they can't have more than two drinks every lunch. You're going to have a problem.
No ceiling fans now, okay? Businesses use ceiling fans. Homes, I mean, I love ceiling fans. You're going to have, or you have to replace them with new specified ceiling fans, which is going to put a third of the business, the ceiling fan business, so, you know, anti-manufacturing, John. I mean, this is exactly the wrong approach. But it is, they want to control. I like Mark's idea, the police state central planners there in Washington. They're going to tell us how to live, basically how to live. And, what, and the appliance story continues. And by the way, you know, Trump is so strong on appliances. Listen, National Economic Council that I ran under Trump, we spent a lot of time pulling regs together, regulations together, that would, allow people strong shower heads, strong water flow, let toilets flush properly, all those kinds of things. Biden is repealing this. People hate this. I mean, they're in the middle of your life. They're telling you how to live, John. I mean, it's an incredible story.
Here's a thing where I think actually Trump's very practical experience as a guy who ran hotels and resorts and casinos actually comes in. He knows how much being comfortable and convenience means to his customers. Mm. And so when he sees that they're saying, you know, you have to have a shower that won't clean you off and you have to have a toilet that won't flush properly, he knows how annoying that is to people. And frankly, I think there's almost a sort of pseudo-religious aspect to this. Mm. The left sees things that make people comfortable and decides that angers the climate gods and has to be eliminated. So, you know, again, showers that work, the ceiling fan. I actually just rushed out and bought a ceiling fan because we're going to have a shortage of good ceiling fans because they're going to ban the ones that work. So I have a little gazebo in my backyard. I want to install a ceiling fan to keep it cool back there. Mm. And I'm afraid they're going to ban them. You know what else is going to happen? They're going to make it so that the only ones you can get are going to be manufactured abroad because they'll put the restrictions on U.S. manufacturers. And yet somehow the ones that come from China will be, you know, waved through and they won't be the restriction. So, again, it'll hurt U.S. manufacturers. It'll help foreign manufacturers. This is the way it always works. It's crippling to the U.S. economy. And frankly, like I said, there's no sense in it. Nobody actually thinks these things help. It's just almost a religious sense.
You know, Mark, you just used that phrase, police states. Has any of these politicos used that? I think that's a great line.
Yeah, it's a police state. They'll come. They'll tell you how much you're allowed to make, how much you're allowed to drink. They'll come into your house and take your microwave and take everything. And you talk about kitchen table. These are the real kitchen table issues. If you're sitting there sweating at the kitchen table and you haven't had a real shower, you can't. Your food isn't cooked.
Should have a beer to cool off.
The police state, that is a heck of a line, and you're absolutely right. I got to remember that. They should use that, all of them.
Wait till they learn how popular air fryers are. I bet they're going to come after those as well, because people love those things, and they hate the things that are making people happy. So they're going to just have to come after those eventually as well.
These rules are being passed down by guys. Each one of them has 6 houses, 12 planes, 19 cars.
Right. These are wealthy people who have the creature comforts they want. They can afford to replace appliances. They can afford to do that. You're exactly right. They can probably make custom-made appliances, for God's sake. John Carney, I got a short...
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We are very honored to have... Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Alan Dershowitz come on the show, talk a little bit about some of these Trump indictments, particularly the one in Georgia. Mr. Dershowitz is the author of Get Trump, The Threat to Civil Liberties, Due Process, and Our Constitutional Rule of Law. He is perhaps the most famous attorney and law professor in the United States, and among maybe the most respected. Alan, if I may personally, thank you for helping us on a Saturday morning. We're very grateful to you for doing this.
Hey, I'm a big fan of yours, so anytime you ask, I'm always going to say yes.
You're great. You've been great on the show. And I know you're not voting for Trump. I get that. Right. But your legal arguments, let me start this. Let me see. The DailyMail.com, I'll just read the header. Alan Dershowitz, colon. Al Gore, his legal team, and I tried to find uncounted presidential votes, lobbied officials, and fought in the courts in 2000. The only difference now, the candidate's name is Donald Trump. That's why this prosecution is an outrage. I remember the 2000 thing all too well. I was on the side of George W. Bush, but I thought the whole thing was an incredible story. So why are the Trump, why is Trump and his people being prosecuted now when you all weren't back then?
We were praised. I mean, I wrote a bestseller book about it called Supreme Injustice, which got great reviews from the New York Times and everybody else. The difference is a change in time and a change in person. You know, today's portion of the Bible that's read, it's my 72nd anniversary of my bar mitzvah today. The portion of the week gives an instruction to prosecutors and judges, and it says, do not recognize faces. That's the ultimate instruction to a judge and a prosecutor. Justice shouldn't depend on who the person is. Wear a blindfold. The statue of justice with a blindfold comes from this biblical command. Do not recognize faces. And that's what our system has turned into. It's all about who you are, what party you're from, what views you represent, you know, what color you are, what gender you are. It's all about faces today. And that's that you can't have justice when it depends on who the person is. Now, look, what Al Gore did was much more, much better from a moral point of view than what Donald Trump did. He conceded victory, even though it was a 5-4 decision, and it was very close, and I think the Supreme Court was wrong. You might think it was right. But he did the right thing. He said, look, I lost. I'm going to go to the inauguration. I'm going to recognize the next president. Donald Trump didn't do that. He made that speech on January 6th, which I thought was terrible. So what he did was wrong, but was it criminal? And the answer is no, it wasn't. You don't make criminal out of matters of degree. And the difference between what we did on behalf of Gore and what the people who have been indicted in Georgia did on behalf of Donald Trump is a matter of degree. And the best way to test that, assume for a moment that Trump was right. Assume for a moment that the election actually went the wrong way in Georgia, that he had enough votes to win. If he had been right, he'd be praised for what he did. Everything in the indictment today would be something he'd be honored for. Oh, my God. He discovered a flawed election. He got it turned around. Everybody should be happy with that. I don't think he was right, but he thinks he was right. And a crime like RICO and conspiracy is in the mind of the defendant. So if he wouldn't have been prosecuted had he been right, he should not be prosecuted if he was wrong, but he honestly believed he was right. And that, to me, is the basic flaw of the Georgia prosecution. And then this prosecutor, this lying, lying prosecutor, looks at the American public and says, I want to bring this case to trial in 6 months. It's not going to happen. You know it's not going to happen. And a bunch of amicus curiae Republicans, good people, wrote a brief in the Washington, D.C. case saying they want the trial to start on January 2nd, 2014. That's 4 months and 3 weeks after the indictment. Never in the history of the country has anybody ever been brought to trial on a RICO charge or charges complicated like this in 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. It's usually over a year.
Professor, is this so? It's politicized. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Of course, it never would happen if the shoe were on the other foot.
Right. By the way, you know, going back to the year 2000 and all that, I remember the final concession speech that Al Gore made, which Alan was a hell of a speech. Maybe the best speech he'd ever given. You know, it's funny. I know Al Gore. I mean, I've talked to him in years. There was a time in the '80s and early '90s when I agreed with a lot of what Al Gore said.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I'm not a fan of all of his climate stuff, but some of his other stuff was quite good, particularly foreign policy. So basically the point is you're saying you all lobbied officials, you fought in the courts, you were looking for additional votes. It's very similar to what Trump has done here.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't on any such phone calls, but I can easily imagine a phone call where Larry Tribe or David Boies, the main lawyers for Al Gore, were saying, we got to find 600 votes. I'm sure they're there. Mm. Just have recount after recount. Pick your counties carefully. Remember what we did in the Gore case. We didn't seek a recount in the entire state because we thought we'd lose that. We sought a recount only in selected counties. And that was a little bit of, you know, of partisan politics, but you play partisan politics when you're representing a partisan. But you could criticize us for that. It's not a crime. And, you know, I think, again, the best test of whether there's a crime charge in Georgia is would that same crime have been charged if he turned out to be right?
Mm.
You know, when Jamie Raskin, my former student, who I gave a good grade in criminal law, I would take it back now if I could. He gave the analogy, the stupidest analogy. He would have gotten an F if he had given this analogy. He said, well, you can't go and rob a bank if you think they shortchanged you. No, of course not. But you can't rob a bank even if they actually shortchanged you. Even if you have proof, 100% proof, that they stole the money from you, you can't go back and do it. Best proof of that is, remember O.J. Simpson? He went and tried to retrieve his trophies and stuff that he knew and correctly knew had been stolen from him. And he spent, what, 6 years in jail for that?
Yes.
So, you know, of course the analogy is not at all there. You can't rob a bank no matter what, but you can challenge an election, and if you're right, you get praised for it.
Professor Dershowitz, you have another piece out. The Hunter Biden special counsel appointment is blatantly illegal. Could you just talk a bit about that, please?
Yeah, there's a regulation that says you have to pick the special counsel from outside the government. And last night I proposed something which was painful for me to propose because, you know, I know President Biden. I've known him since 1980. I like him. I hope to be able to vote for him. But I think the time has come to have a special counsel from outside appointed to investigate the allegations against him as well. In fact, if I were Joe Biden, I would be calling for a special counsel. He'd be better off having some very distinguished former dean, president of a university, you know, somebody beyond reproach, looking at these facts instead of having congressional committees, dueling committees in the Senate, you know, Democrats in the House, Republicans, looking at this with a partisan eye. I think he'd be better off, particularly if he's innocent. You know, I was accused of sexual misconduct about 8 years ago at falsely. But the first thing I did when I was accused is I demanded an FBI investigation. I called for it. I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal. First time ever anybody's ever done that. I said, I will give all of my documents, will not invoke any privileges. I want to be investigated honestly and fairly. Of course, they didn't do it, and then the woman admitted that she may have confused me with somebody else. So if you're innocent, the best defense is to have an independent investigation. And that's why if I were Al Gore, if I were the lawyer for President Biden, if I was convinced he was innocent, I would be the one calling for a special counsel from outside the government.
I never understood, reading all the reports and so forth, with respect to this blanket immunity, which popped up at the court hearing in Wilmington, Delaware, with Judge Noriega. I never understood that. It was on, it was off, it was on, it was off, and then they said, well, no, it's really not on. And then I believe the judge says what asked for constitutional reasons for it, and they couldn't find it. I mean, the whole thing is a big muddle. How do you see that?
Well, remember, I was the only one who predicted over and over again that the judge would not accept the plea bargain. CNN mocked me. Some of my colleagues mocked me. They all said, oh, judges always accept this. It's routine. I said, not in this case. She's not going to accept it because we don't know what the deal is. We're not sure what it covers. Does it cover, you know, what happened allegedly in Ukraine and China? Does it only cover what happened in Delaware? How can you accept the plea bargain if you don't know what its terms are? And she was right, and she refused to accept it. Now, you know, there'll be another plea bargain, I predict. I don't think either side wants to bring this case to trial. The problem is the American public is not going to be confident that the man who makes the plea bargain for the government isn't covering his own rear end. Remember, he made a sweetheart plea bargain, according to a lot of people. He's going to want to justify that. And I think if he now comes up with an indictment that's going to carry a five-year prison term, people are going to say, well, what happened? Why did you agree to a plea bargain when this information was out there? So he's going to be either consciously or unconsciously inclined to try to justify what he did in the past. That's why he's precisely the wrong person to do this investigation.
Do you think at any point in that process that Hunter Biden's foreign financial entanglements will be explored?
I sure hope so. They should be. And I think that if there's any possibility that his father was involved, they should be explored, too. The American public has the right to an objective, neutral, nonpartisan determination of that. So far, neutral and nonpartisan has been read out of our justice system. The justice system today has become so partisan, so dependent on whose party it is, who the person is, race, gender, all of that. It's a terrible, terrible thing. I've been doing this 60 years. I never thought we'd come to this.
Well, you're very brilliant, and you're very gracious to give us your time. Folks, we've been talking to Alan Dershowitz, Professor Emeritus, Harvard Law School. You're a prince, Alan. Thank you ever so
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk to columnist Joe Concha about politics, maybe life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Is the Larry Kudlow Show. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Bring in Mark Mills, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of The Cloud Revolution, How the Convergence of New Technologies Will Unleash the Next Economic Boom and a Roaring 2020s. Wow. Host of the Last Optimist podcast, Mark Mills, welcome. Can we talk about, I want to continue this discussion. John Kerry is going to China. No one knows what he's going to do over there. No one knows what treaties he's making, what deals he's making. The guy's completely unaccountable. But the point is, the White House itself, even though Biden hasn't paid any attention to it, put out a white paper from the Council of Economic Advisors and from the Office of Management and Budget, Mark. And they said, basically, a couple of degrees Fahrenheit warmer has had virtually no impact on our economy. Okay, point number one. Point number two, they want everybody to have electric cars in the next 10 or 20 years, and we don't have the resources, not even remotely the resources to deal with it, because their own policies are preventing the kind of mining for the minerals. So what do you make of this whole story?
I mean, it's bizarre. It's like a form of mass hysteria, because there's this profound disconnect between reports of exactly the kind coming out of this White House that we're seeing a de minimis impact from a modest temperature rise on the planet. The world is slightly warmer. No dispute. Why it's warmer is in dispute. But here's the disconnect. I mean, just trying to get that many electric vehicles on the road, mandating EVs everywhere, to do so would cost trillions of dollars. And you're the economist. You get the same service as a car moving, assuming that they're equal in every respect. You get the same utility function of a vehicle, but it costs trillions more dollars to affect. And the key thing, to your point, is that it doesn't cut CO2 emissions because of the minerals that are required, and they're not produced here. This administration actively opposes expanding new mining, even though they talk about, in policy circles, quote-unquote, subsidizing American domestic mining. It's not happening. It's truly surreal. I mean, frankly, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite as surreal in my career.
You know, you have written about this, the whole commodity angle, minerals, resources, commodities. So digging this stuff up, so if you want to have electric cars, you got to have batteries. So we need all these minerals and commodities to go into batteries. But that excavation will unleash quite a bit of carbon. So isn't that sort of self-defeating?
Well, that's the key pillar of these electric vehicle mandates and bans of conventional cars is to cut CO2 emissions. And you're absolutely right. So what a single EV has a battery that weighs, which most people, I think now know, weighs about 1,000 pounds. And to manufacture that battery somewhere on Earth, you have to dig up, for that one car, something like 500,000 pounds of the Earth using big, heavy oil-burning machinery. I mean, 40% of the world's industrial energy is in mining, and that's before we have an incredible expansion to try to make all the minerals elsewhere. So you end up emitting as much, and sometimes, this is the kicker, more CO2 elsewhere on the planet in service of building an electric car to eliminate the burning hydrocarbons that emit carbon dioxide later. I mean, so words fail, and rarely am I at a loss for words.
it's dog chasing tail. And yes. Look, from a common sense standpoint, how can people not understand that? I'll start with policymakers. How can they not understand that? But ordinary people who look at this story, how can they not understand that? You want an electric vehicle, fine. But we're spending trillions of dollars to subsidize this stuff. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act, Mark, which is the biggest, all these tax credits for EVs, has now been priced at over $1 trillion. But people don't understand what goes into this so that we can actually have these electric vehicles.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. So apart from the Biden scandals, we've still got an inflation problem and a Bidenomics problem. The Consumer Price Index came out this past week. All items, top line up 3.2%. That's certainly better than 9, although last month it was 3.0. The core rate, ex food and energy, 4.7%. And gasoline prices still going up, and so are grocery prices. Anyway, let's talk to my great pal Michael Faulkender, professor of finance at the University of Maryland, chief economist of the AFPI, and former assistant secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy. Michael Faulkender, what did you make of the CPI? Has the progress now bottomed out and we're going to head a little higher, or is there still more downside?
I would say that we're probably starting to head higher after this, because the CPI report does not really include the rise in oil prices and the commensurate increase in gas prices that we're going to see coming, because it occurred at the end of July. And so when you look at the Chinese government looking to reinvigorate their economy, when you look at the impact of the OPEC cuts, those were only at the end of July starting to push oil above $80 a barrel. And Larry, as you recall, it was originally the increase in oil prices that then permeated the rest of the inflation, because as we've talked about for more than a year now, you know, it's not just the production of goods and services, it's also then their transportation, and all of that is going to be impacted by increasing prices of oil. And this comes back to the war on American energy that the Biden administration declared on its first day. And so we don't have the reserves, and they're not going to be able to dip into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to try to offset that this time.
Yeah, they've depleted the SPR. You're exactly right. $3.85 gasoline, AAA, Mike, $3.85. That, I think, got as low as about $3.35 a few months ago. That's going to show up in the top-line CPI, right?
That is. That's right. It'll show up. And it'll also indirectly show up in core, because if you've got petroleum products that go into the manufacturing of non-energy goods, and then you've got the transportation of any kind of goods and services, that's going to raise prices for the production and distribution of those things, and it'll show up in core as well. So it's misleading when people think that if you just look at the core number, you've taken out energy. Well, no, energy still indirectly affects the core number.
I'm still looking at grocery prices up 3.6% year on year. Seems to me that is still a problem. And overall, I mean, if you go all the way back to the beginning of the Biden administration, you know, the CPI has gone up 16%, groceries up 20%, energy up over 30%. I mean, I think people still feel that. no matter what these year-on-year comparisons may show.
That's right, because people never had their wages recover from the inflation that we had from the early part of the administration. And so simply because 12 months have elapsed doesn't mean that people aren't still having challenges in their budget arising from the price increases that occurred earlier on. And so even though they're starting to get lower numbers, as you just said, it's because a lot of the big increases were more than 12 months ago, so they're rolling off the 12-month number. But the price index still has not gone back down to where, you know, anywhere close, and it probably won't, to where it was when the Biden administration took office. And so unless we get significant wage gains, Joe Biden's going to be going up for reelection, you know, running on Bidenomics that has led to some of the steepest losses in real wages in a long time.
What happens to the rest of the economy? I see the ISM, Institute of Supply Managers, manufacturing continues under 50%, Michael, I think the eighth straight month. And I think the ISM for services showed some additional weakness, and the housing market looks still soft. What's your overall view of the economy?
So the consumer-driven part of the economy looks weak. So we're not seeing significant increases in retail sales. As you said, households are not making significant reductions in residential investment as a result of the 22-year high interest rates that we're facing. Instead, what we're seeing is a lot of the growth coming out of government spending. And we talked about that also, Larry, for the last two jobs reports in a row. The significant growth has been on the government side, whether it's government directly or it's things that government pay for, like health care and social services. That's what's been driving some of the recent growth. And so, again, what is Bidenomics for people? It is government-directed, top-down, massive deficit spending that's unsustainable. And that's why we're seeing very low productivity numbers under this administration. And of course, Biden admitted that this week, right? I mean,
you got to it before I did.
Well, I was wondering when we were going to get to it, because the notion that Biden actually came out and said, no, the Inflation Reduction Act wasn't really about reducing inflation.
At a Democratic fundraiser, I'm going to give you the quote. I wish I hadn't called it that, because it has less to do with inflation than it has to do with providing alternatives that generate economic growth. What's he talking about, alternatives that generate economic growth?
Well, that's what's funny, is because when you and I talk about growth, we're talking about private sector investment and engaging in activities such that people want to work and be productive. He's back to your favorite Keynesian types of models that say, well, if the government spends a lot of the money, that's the source of economic growth. But of course, if government spending is directed towards low productivity activities and it crowds out private sector actions, then no, it, if anything, stifles growth. He and his friends at his Council of Economic Advisors are full of Keynesians who think that government spending's got some massive multiplier on it that's going to generate growth, even though we know that that's not consistent with reality.
You know, that misnamed Inflation Reduction Act, that the original estimates, I don't know, were about $350 billion, but that has been reestimated because of these open-ended subsidies for electric vehicles and whatnot. I mean, that thing could be $700-800 billion. I mean, so there's some serious government spending potential in that bill. But you're right. That's the way they look at the world. It's all about government. It's not about private investment.
That's right. It's not the American people deciding what kind of cars they want to drive or what kind of stoves they want to use. It's Biden's bureaucrats saying, well, we don't like internal combustion engine cars. And so even though Congress said that the batteries have to come from the United States or from countries that have trade relations, free trade agreements with the United States, we're just going to rewrite the rules. We're going to ignore that part of it. And so his Treasury Department puts out a set of rules that, as you said, caused Goldman Sachs to say that that bill is going to come in hundreds of billions of dollars more than they had originally forecasted, because they're just going to ignore the sourcing requirements. So just so everybody understands, we're going to borrow money from China to run massive deficits so that we can import cars from China and in the process displace American workers who are making the things that Americans actually want to buy. That is Bidenomics.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Actually, you know what? You reminded me. I think the Goldman estimate was $1.2 trillion. And I think the Penn Wharton estimate was something similar to that also. Mike Falkender, what's the Federal Reserve going to talk about? They're meeting in a couple of weeks at their famous Jackson Hole meeting. Do you go to that, by the way? Did they invite you to that?
I have not yet been invited to it. I look forward to the day when I'm part of that invite list. You know, another group who hasn't invited me, Larry, is the World Economic Forum at Davos. I'm not too high on that list either. So
I used to go to that Fed conference, and then all of a sudden I wasn't invited anymore. That was quite a few years ago. What do you think Jay Powell's message is now with inflation at 3.2 and possibly headed higher?
You know, I think he knows full well that his legacy is going to be whether or not he gets inflation back to 2% by the time his term is up. And so I think he's going to be singularly focused on that. He knows that the legacy of the reputation of Fed chairman come down to their management of inflation. And given that he was at the helm claiming transitory inflation when we got the 40-year high inflation rates that we did, I think he's going to nearly be singularly focused on that and keep raising rates until he gets the recession creating a 2% inflation rate that he's demanding.
All right. Michael Falkender, great rundown. Nobody does it better. We appreciate it very much. Folks, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Nicole Jalinas of the Manhattan Institute. This New York City migrant problem, illegal migrant problem, is just off the charts. It's a complete and utter disaster. And it doesn't look like there's any solution in sight. We're going to take a break. Nicole Jalinas up next. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Larry Kudlow. Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great to be with you today. We have special guests coming all the way from Britain. My friend Nigel Farage, by the way, is the host of the number one rated political news show in the UK. It's called Farage on Great Britain News. He's a former leader of the Brexit Party. Nigel, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. You're terrific to do this. We appreciate it. You were great on the TV show. Nigel, can we just talk for a moment about your battle of bank accounts in London, in Britain, and NatWest, and the guy had to resign? Because this is a story, by the way, that we hear about in the U.S., debanking because you're not woke enough. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, I've been with a banking group called NatWest, National Westminster, since 1980. I've run all my personal accounts. I ran my business accounts while I worked in the commodity markets in the City of London before my political career. I currently have a service company that I run through there that does some property investments and gets a bit of media income and things like that. And just out of the blue, I get a phone call followed by a letter to say, we're closing your accounts. Hmm. I asked, is there any reason? We don't have to give a reason. So I thought, well, I'm not really very happy with this because this has been happening to a lot of my colleagues. Funny, isn't it? Anybody that happens to be a strong Eurosceptic that supported the campaign to leave the European Union, that thinks we should have proper border controls, that doesn't believe that four-year-olds should be read nighttime stories by drag queens or whatever else it may be. So this had happened to a few friends of mine. I thought, right, I'm going to stand and fight. And I was able to use a legal mechanism. And the legal mechanism got me my personal data from the bank. So the bank had said, give me no reason. I went public to say, this is a scandal. It's happening to too many people. The boss of the bank then decided they briefed the BBC. Well, of course they briefed the BBC, wouldn't they? Because they're all globalists together. And the briefing was that I'd been debanked because I now had insufficient funds in my account to be commercially viable. Anyway, I used this legal mechanism to get my personal data, and on my file, it said, we will close his accounts because he does not align with the values of the bank.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. I'm Larry, I'm Embrace Yourself audience, because You know, I may be one of the worst human beings that's ever appeared on this network, but I'm thought to be xenophobic because I didn't want to be controlled by Brussels. I'm thought to be racist because I believe in border controls. I'm thought to be out of touch with modern society because I retweeted a joke by Ricky Gervais.
Wow.
So anyway, this whole thing exploded. They debanked me for political reasons. Mm. The boss had lied about it. She was forced to resign. Mm. Now we learn she's going to get a big payoff, which I'm going to fight. But interestingly, the act of me speaking out, so many other people have now spoken out. This is a real scandal that's going on. And frankly, it is, and it sounds hysterical, but it's verging on political persecution.
Mm.
But you see, ESG, Larry, the whole ESG agenda, it started about 20 years ago, and that wokeism is getting ever more deep inside the banking industry. This week, I'm going to be exposing some examples of the insurance industry behaving in exactly the same way. And really, what we're talking about here is, why don't banks just be banks?
Right.
Insurance companies just be insurance companies. And why doesn't the regulator, because I mean, all these financial markets are regulated, I mean, some might argue over-regulated. It seems the regulators in America have tolerated this behavior, and in this country, on this side of the pond, they virtually encouraged it. Well, I'm very pleased to say that Rishi Sunak, our Prime Minister, Jeremy Hunt, our Finance Minister, our Chancellor of the Exchequer, they've spoken out very strongly, not just in support of me, but in support of the principle that it's utterly wrong in a free society to take away people's accounts on the basis of their views. And they have instructed the regulator to make change. So maybe, just maybe, we can turn this crazy tide.
So good. The Tory party has taken this up, and they are fighting this through as a big issue.
Yeah, I think, you know, that they probably said to themselves, God, you know, here's another issue on which public support. Perhaps we better do what he says. but at least they've acted. At least they have acted. They've given this instruction. But what we do need is regulatory change, because one of the problems that goes right through our financial systems is this fear of money laundering. Mm-hmm. Now, look, we know that there are tens of billions of dollars worth of illegal drug money that get laundered around the world every month. We know that's true. And of course we want to find a way, if we can, of stopping it. But the problem with the legislation is the legislation that gets put in tends to affect small companies who might receive an unusual payment and the bank panics. It's like a sledgehammer to miss the nut. And what the banks are doing now, and you'll notice this, it's happening in Australia, it's happening here quite aggressively, is they're restricting access to cash. They're saying, you know, you cannot draw out your own cash from your bank account. You can only withdraw a tiny amount. If you're a small business, say you run a fish stall, you know, and you're taking cash over a fish stall, well, the banks don't really want your business. And there is a willful attempt, and this is the really biggest issue of all that I've uncovered. There is a willful attempt to drive out cash. Now, our government has a pilot project starting in 2030. They're recruiting right now to introduce central bank digital currencies.
Right.
That would give banks and government total control over what we spend money on, over how we spend money, and frankly, if you allied that to political debanking, which has happened to me, well, quite frankly, you wouldn't be too far away from a Chinese social credit system, where the only people allowed to participate fully in society are those who have the correct fashionable views. So I think there's a really massive issue. These really are massive issues that are at stake.
It's growing here. I mean, you read a lot of stories. For example, the Bank of America. You read a lot of stories about woke debanking. Okay, same, almost identical to the one you've just described, your own story. They want political correctness based on their views. It aligns with the Biden administration based on their views. You also have, Nigel, talking about digital currency, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department here are talking about the same thing, a U.S. digital currency, a Federal Reserve digital currency, which would give them total control over financial flows. And I think this is a growing issue. I think this is a growing issue.
No, it is. And, of course, you know, I mean, here we have huge restrictions being put on commercial companies in terms of carbon dioxide usage and emissions. I mean, I honestly can see a time when, oh, you fancy booking a flight to go on holiday with the kids? No, sorry, you've used your carbon allowance for the year. Yeah. I mean, you can see exactly. You want to buy a gun? Oh, no, I'm sorry, but you've got a gun already. We don't think, really, you should have another one. Yeah, it would be very, very easy for this system to be horribly abused. But I think, really, I think the more we can talk about this, the more we can get people to understand this, the more chance there is of stopping it. And I'll tell you this, I mean, I've always been seen to be a bit of a divisive figure because campaigning to leave a political union we've been part of for almost half a century, well, a lot of people quite like the status quo. And it was a 52-48. And kind of walking down the street, the reactions I get are 52-48 from people. But suddenly on this issue, my website's been flooded with messages of people saying, look, Nigel, I wasn't with you on Brexit, but on this issue of free speech, of fairness, of avoiding digital currencies, we're 100% behind you. And this is one of those issues. I mean, it shouldn't really be a left-right issue. You know, basic issues of free speech.
These are freedom issues.
That's what they are. I mean, in the old days, the left would have embraced this.
Yeah.
Back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to reset. You can live stream us on the internet, by the way. This show live streams on the internet. It's Larry Kudlow. No. Yeah, LarryKudlowShow.com, LarryKudlowShow.com. You can get us all across the country, around the world, throughout the solar system, and the Milky Way. During the week, Fox Business, the name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. every day. If you can't get it at 4, you can hear it at 7 replay, or text your favorite 9-year-old who will show you how to DVR the show. Let's do some stock market work. Stocks are bouncing around this past week. The Dow is off 154 points, but the NASDAQ was up 300. The S&P up 36. We'll go to our experts, Nancy Tengler, CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Laffer Tengler Investments, and Jim LeCamp, Senior Vice President for Investments at Morgan Stanley. Welcome back, kids. So, I don't know. I have a few things to talk about. Stocks seem to be bouncing around. Interest rates have moved up in recent weeks. Jay Powell talking at Jackson Hole and the rest of the world. Nancy Tengler, what's going on here? What's your outlook?
Larry, don't you know we're navigating by the stars under cloudy skies?
Yeah. What does that mean? That's what he said. I don't know what that means.
I have no idea. I feel like I do it every day, though. So I think a couple of things. I didn't think the speech said much of anything, and I think you saw that in the market's response. I do, however, think there's a couple of things going on underneath the surface, and one is this GDP Now number that I think really has driven the bear steepening in the yield curve. You know, we've got the 10-year rising, the 2-year flat, and that's only happened less than 10% of the time. And so if you look back historically, and it tells you that the market thinks growth is accelerating and the Fed is likely to increase. I don't think that's the case. I think one of the things that's been driving growth is the fiscal stimulus that's in place and may in fact be starting to sort of wane just as we get the impact of the lagged effects of monetary policy. So I think you still want to be cautious. You still want to own companies that are growing their earnings and can grow their earnings in the face of a slowing economy. But I wouldn't take that GDP now number to the bank and extrapolate it out to infinity, because I just don't think that's where we are.
What is it? It's 5.9% for the third quarter.
Right. Right.
And yep. We don't know. I mean, that's just based on the recent numbers. Let's see, in July, but we don't know that that's going to happen, and they can revise that substantially. But rates correct. Have gone up a lot, Jim LeCamp. I mean, the 10-year is holding now at about 4.25%, and the curve is still pretty steeply inverted, which is still a future recession signal. And the numbers coming in, you know, things like the manufacturing reports from the Empire State and elsewhere don't look that great, Jim LeCamp. So what is your outlook?
So it's not just those numbers. We have leading indicators down 16, 17
right.
months in a row.
Right.
We have PMIs around the world in downtrends. They have revised the BLS numbers, which have one too many letters in their acronym. Hmm. They have revised those down for every single month this year.
For jobs.
Metric and you need to revise every single reading, maybe you should change your calculations, maybe you should change your birth-death models, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is, and then you've got declines in China, too, which will impact not only global stock markets, but they likely have an impact on the global economic situation. So, yeah, I think the economy is not in as good a shape as advertised, and you've got this inverted yield curve that's gone on for a long time, and a lot of people have gotten comfortable with it. But if you look at the history of inverted yield curves, there is a lag effect, and we are not beyond the parameters of what historical lag effects have been with inverted yield curves and their ability to predict recessions. In the meantime, earnings are down. Yeah, everybody compares earnings to expectations, but not enough time is spent looking on whether they're actually going up or down nominally, and they're going down. And so we've got a market at a very rich valuation with breadth that's not that good. You have leaders that are showing toppy behavior. You had this buy the rumor, sell the fact move this week in NVIDIA. And so to me, and then you've got the seasonality of this all, where, you know, historically, September, early October have been very, very volatile and somewhat weak in the markets. So I think I agree with Nancy. It's not a time to be taking a lot of risks. Energy stocks still look okay, but everything else really looks pretty heavy here.
Crude oil's holding at $80, $80.50. Gasoline prices about $3.85. Brent crude, $84.77. But those two have not changed recently. The gasoline price actually is, after rising, is now holding at that point. So, Nancy, what's the energy story? What's the gasoline story? And related to that, the stocks, what's that story?
Yeah, well, so agree with Jim on energy for sure. We have been trimming our upstream exposure and reallocating that into integrated oil names. And the reason for that is just that we think we've seen a lot of the move in the price of oil, and now we want to try to make money in the refining and integrated portion of the space. But, you know, we've talked about this, Larry. We have a clean energy strategy, and you know, clean energy is definitely a misnomer, because by the time you mine for all the required minerals and metals, you've destroyed great parts of the of the society and the, you know, the world's supply, and we're going to be short. And so we know that, and we want to make money if we can in that space, but we have hedged it with oil, and we think we will continue to see oil stocks outperform in the coming decades. All the while, we continue to get this forced central planning push towards green energy. There's a real quick chart that I'll just cite. It was from our friends at Strategus. They looked at, you know, what it would take of current production if you wanted to produce 18 million vehicles, EVs. And you'd need 88% of the lithium supply currently. You need 71% of graphite, 32% of cobalt. And we've got companies that are abandoning cobalt mines because they just can't. One is Jervois, who 10 years in the making, way over budget. They finally just shuttered it. So there's going to have to be a realization that this notion of clean energy needs to be reassessed, and we're going to have to get the environmentalists on board for the mining aspect of it, because otherwise we're going to just continue to, you know, be
And adding to that, emerging markets own 76% of the world's oil supply, and the rig count is down 16% here in the U.S. year over year. Now, let's not forget that there's depletion on all these rigs and wells as well. So when you have a rig count that's in decline here in the U.S. and global demand that's still very high, the math is pretty easy to – it's supply and demand 101. The math is pretty easy to do. And to Nancy's point also, there is pushback now on not only electric vehicles, but on a lot of these initiatives, this ESG initiatives. I know you saw the news from BlackRock of voting against a lot of these this week. So there is pushback on not only EVs, but all the ESG initiatives, and that should be pro-energy in terms of fossil fuels.
Because of scarcity.
Yes.
Yeah, I know, because, which is stupid. The whole thing is stupid, because prices would be much – gasoline would be $2 if you just let them drill, drill, drill. Drill, baby, drill.
Right.
I mean, really, what's the point? The clean energy thing is an obsession. Nobel Prize winners are calling climate change a hoax. It's not just Vivek Ramaswamy or Donald Trump. Nobel Prize winners are calling climate change a hoax. The only people who believe this stuff are in Washington, D.C. and the Biden administration. Phil Murphy, the governor of New Jersey, who's a very lovely man, by the way, he just came out, no more gas-powered cars by 2035. But wait, you can buy used cars, used gas-powered cars. You just can't buy new ones. I mean, how stupid is that? Really? That's almost as stupid as saying you can't have a ceiling fan. The Energy Department just came out, no ceiling fans. What is up with this?
They're trying to blame Maui now on climate change.
Right.
They had a guy in control of the water supply who, because he was worried about inclusion, held off water supply for hours.
Yes.
But it's climate change.
Yeah, and they wouldn't let the utility deal with the problems of special grass and other firefighting mechanisms. I mean, these policies are making it worse. We're straying from the stock market, but the reality is these policies are making it worse. We should be growing the economy at 5% with no inflation. And by the way, I want to come back and talk about the dollar and commodities. Nancy Tengler's got a new ETF. We've got to hear from that. And Jim LeCamp's got a strategy. Nancy Tengler, CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Laffer Tengler, Jim LeCamp of Morgan Stanley. I'm Kudlow. There's too much craziness out there.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Talks with Nancy Tengler, CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Laffer Tengler Investments, and Jim LeCamp, Senior Vice President for Investments at Morgan Stanley. Nancy Tengler, you got a new ETF. What's cooking?
Oh,
I want to get rich.
Up, Larry.
I want the non-rich to get rich. I want the Kudlow Trust to get What do you got? Real fast.
Me too, and that's why we did it. Our minimums at Laffer Tengler are pretty high, and so we wanted to take our core strategy, which has a pretty strong track record of very high ratings from the independent rating people, and we wanted to make it accessible to the average individual. The core strategy, it uses the same valuation metrics I've used since the mid-1980s. when I first met you, actually, and it works. And so we launched in August, fourth month of the year, to launch an ETF. But we braced the volatile markets, and we're looking forward to really having the opportunity to share it with the rest of the country.
What's the ticket? What's the ticket? How much?
It's the ticker is TGLR. So Taylor,
no, how much do I, and how much do I need to play?
Oh, minimum, whatever your broker, $5, $10, you can, whatever it takes to buy a share. Yeah, it's for the average investor, and that's exactly what we wanted.
Jim LeCamp, you know, she's pretty smart, Jim. She's got a good track record. I've known her a long time. She's very good. I don't know, maybe you put a couple of bucks in there.
And I studied Art Laffer when I was a freshman economics student at Baylor University. So I've known the team a long time. you were talking about emerging markets. I just want to point out, if you were going to do mean reversion, you'd be all over it. But mean reversion is kind of like waiting for a Godot. You better wait for the whites of their eyes before you do that. And demand over there is really, really weak. Now, they're expanding the BRICS to include those other countries, and they're going to have a stronghold on a lot of commodities. So it's going to be something, I think, the next decade is going to be full of discussion about, but it's not there quite yet in terms of moving the market, and we just need to wait till these trends start to develop.
But, Jim, what about the China story?
Financial
problems, real estate problems, the economy is sputtering, the currency is going down. What about, I mean, I'm interested in the China story because of the China implosion, but also what's the impact on the U.S. and the rest of the world?
I think it has a big impact. I think China is hesitating. They can stimulate more than they have, and ultimately I think they will. At some point, there will be a big bazooka over there, and Chinese stocks, the valuations are really cheap right now. If they don't, if they decide to let markets go ahead and go where they would go, and they don't normally do this, they hardly ever do it, then you've got a real problem, because emerging markets in Europe are not in good shape in the first place. And if the rest of the world sinks, we've already got a market that's overvalued here in the first place. It's going to be a headwind.
And Nancy, Mickey Levy's article, his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, China pays for economic mismanagement. The bill is coming due for Beijing's rejection of free enterprise in favor of communist ideals. I mean, that's a big story. I think Mickey Levy got it exactly right. The Deng Xiaoping reforms are dead. China's gradually moved away from free enterprise. And she has moved it much further from free enterprise. I mean, China is, that story is going to be very important. That's a sinking story. It has geopolitical implications, and it has financial implications.
For sure. And yet we're starting to emulate some of those same policies here in the U.S., where we have witnessed, we can see exactly what happens. This is maybe where Jim and I diverge. I still think it's too early to get back into China. We've been advocating not to for a couple of years. Okay. Sorry, Jim. I didn't mean to mischaracterize.
No problem. I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. And this was, while BlackRock was doubling their allocation to China, and now, it's as though they don't even know where China is in their global allocation. So I think investors, there's plenty, one of the things Jim mentioned earlier that I think is super important is that the lack of breadth in this rally is in fact a fact, but it's also given us a lot of opportunity, because there's some really high quality names, and in particular, the short cycle industrials that are benefiting from all the government spending. We have found some really attractive places to put capital. So think of a name like Emerson or Carrier that also fit our theme of old economy companies that are embracing the digital revolution and AI, cloud computing, et cetera. So we think there's still plenty of places in the U.S., and that's where we're focused. Stay away from China for some time would be my advice.
Yeah, stay away from China. Jim LeCamp, I got 40 seconds. What's your strategy?
Keep a lot of cash right now. We can get 5% on money market, CDs, T-bills, and wait for, I don't hate the areas that Kathy just mentioned. I actually do like those areas. But, yeah, as I've told you before, Larry, if we get into a bear trend in this market, they're not going to take any prisoners. Everybody dies in the end. And you can, if you have lots of cash right now, you can get paid for it. There is an alternative. And you can wait for some of these things to wash out. I think you can play them. But also I think you can buy energy in here and some of the materials names.
Yeah, you get 5%. 5% cash. It's not bad.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to do some money in politics with our regulars, Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist Steve Moore, FreedomWorks, and Committee to Unleash Prosperity Hotline, and following most of these same stations, WABC radio host, More Money. Radio host of More Money. All right, kids, get ready. A few Bidens. This is the police state. You can only have two drinks a week. That's number one. I don't drink, but I haven't had a drink in 28 years. But two drinks a week, no ceiling fans, New Jersey, no new gas-powered cars, and the Justice Department is suing Elon Musk because he's hiring Americans rather than illegal immigrants. Now, there's something wrong with this story. There is, Steve, you're all right, Steve Moore. You can take one, two, five, go. What is wrong with this picture?
You know, as I think I said a few weeks ago on your show, they're going to rename the BATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, Gas Stoves, Pizza Ovens, Air Conditioners, and now what is it, ceiling fan?
Ceiling fans.
It's preposterous, really. I mean, this is the new left-wing kind of Stalinistic approach to dealing with climate change. That is there any appliance in your house, Liz, that you can buy without the government? You know, what about light bulbs? I mean, it's amazing. Once upon a time, the left wanted to keep the government out of people's homes, and now just about everything that you want to buy is being regulated by government.
Liz Peek, can't have your ceiling fan. I don't know whether you have one in New York or Nantucket. We have ceiling fans everywhere. A lot of businesses use ceiling fans. And Liz Peek, only two drinks a week. Earlier in the show, Mark Simone said that's going to lose the female housewife.
It's really true. The Chardonnay crowd out the door.
Crowd.
You know, the ceiling fan thing is completely nuts, because if you don't going to run your air conditioning at a very low level or high level, depending on how you look at it, which is green, right? You're not supposed to have your house or your air conditioning set at 70 degrees. They want you at 75 or 80 degrees. How do you make up the difference? How do you make it comfortable for people? You have a ceiling fan. I mean, that just seems so completely nuts to me. But actually, Larry, the story I'm glad you raised is this persecution, and I would use that word, of Elon Musk. This is making me crazy, this story. I saw it the other night on the news about how SpaceX is being sued. And by the way, the Justice Department is singling out SpaceX for this, for not hiring asylees, a word I've never heard before, but people seeking asylum, who, by the way, until they have asylum, are in the country illegally. Can we get over that? And other kinds of immigrants who have not yet gotten their papers, for not hiring those people. SpaceX is a rocket company. It is very essential to what Elon Musk is doing in terms of national security and security in places like Ukraine, where he is supplying by far and away the majority of satellite communication systems for troops on the ground for the war effort in Ukraine. So guess what? There is a law that says that like armaments companies are not supposed to hire people in the country illegally. Actually, there was a day not that long ago when no one was supposed to hire people in the country illegally. But this is a national security issue. I saw that, and actually I'm writing about it now. It is infuriating to me to have this guy singled out, his company singled out, when on the face of it, it is such a preposterous charge.
Steve Moore, I'm going to read you. This was one of Elon Musk's tweets or X's or whatever they're called. Quote, U.S. law requires at least a green card to be hired at SpaceX, as rockets are advanced weapons technology.
Yeah.
Which goes to Liz's point. I mean, Steve, come on. This is insanity. This is total insanity. And this is part of the police state. Mark Simone called it a police state move. And this is also antithetical to national security. This is nuts.
So it, what's really interesting about the whole story is that let's say that Elon Musk started hiring thousands of illegal immigrants. You know, then they raid his factory and say, look at Elon Musk. He's not hiring American workers. He's trying to undercut American workers by hiring illegals. The other thing that's so interesting about all of these kind of incidents you're talking about is that the left has become – they've become the new Puritans, right? Mm. I mean – They want to regulate every aspect of, and you can't smoke, you can't drink, you can't da-da-da-da-da, just about anything. What about, I think pretty soon they're going to make sugar illegal.
Pretty soon, by the way.
Actually, they tried to. Mike Bloomberg, remember, wanted to cut down on sugar intake anyway by banning large drinks, so that instead of a large drink, you'd have to buy two drinks, which was really bizarre.
By the way, two drinks, that's it. Two beers. Yeah. If you have a third beer,
I'm
going to
make a prediction, Larry. Larry, I think they're going to pretty soon they're going to make sex illegal.
Oh, well, they're moving. What kind of sex? I mean, that let's not go there. If you have three beers a week in Wisconsin, you're out. You're going to jail.
Wow. What are they thinking?
Three beers a week in Chicago, Steve Moore. All right, St. Patrick's Day. I want to know about St. Patrick's Day. That's a year's worth of allocation right there. In all seriousness, this is stuff that the Republicans should be raising, because I don't think the country. I mean, it didn't really come up in the debate, but this police state stuff or Stalinist stuff or whatever we're going to call it. Wait a second. The other one that's interesting is New Jersey Governor Murphy. Okay, he's a nice guy, by the way. I know him. But no gas-powered cars, so they're adopting the California model. But, Steve, you can have used cars. You just can't buy a new gas-powered car. Now,
here's the thing about that, though, that, you know, did you see that the average car, new car costs like $46,000 now? Mm-hmm. I mean, so you can't afford to buy a new car anymore. I mean, right. I don't believe that inflation is only 3.5%. I'm sorry, but when you look at the sticker price of airline tickets, of cars, of groceries, of filling up your tank, I'm sorry. I think these statistics are very skewed. And you know what? Most Americans, I bet most people listening to the show probably agree with me, that the things you have to buy are up so much in price. I think inflation is closer to 10 or 15%.
Well, Liz Peek, what's Jay Powell going to do about inflation?
Well, good question, because what he's doing isn't working. Well, I shouldn't say that. If you think that inflation has come down to 3%, 3.5% from 9%, I guess he should be taking a victory lap. But we are now at a point, and we've talked about this before, where it's like delivery companies, that last mile is the really tricky part. And I think getting to 2% is the really tricky part. And he reiterated yesterday in Jackson Hole that is his ambition. Well, you can raise interest rates right now to 20%. And I really wonder how much impact it's not going to have any impact on the housing market. We know that because there's no movement in the housing market. People are hanging on to their homes because they have a 2% mortgage or 3% mortgage, and they're sure not going to move if it goes to, you know, 15%. In other businesses, maybe it will make a tremendous difference. You'll have a financial crisis at some point. But I really wonder how effective this program is. I mean, they've shrunk the Fed balance sheet enormously. I think the real rate of real interest rate is not 5.5%, is probably more like 8 or 9, because if you include that shrinkage of the balance sheet, they're making it very difficult for businesses to finance, take loans out, to finance purchases of other businesses. They're really squashing the economy, and it hasn't shown up very much yet in the data. I think it will, but I don't know what other program he's got in mind. And, you know, by the way, all this is happening in the context of slowing growth around the world. So it is kind of a high price to pay for that last that last 1% or 1.5%, I think.
I'll give him credit, though, Steve Moore. He, Paul Krugman, a big favorite of ours, he said just raise the inflation target to 3 or 4. And Powell said no. Powell said no, we're going to stay at 2.
Yeah.
So I give him credit for that. We'll see how he, you know, what he does in the months ahead. I think rates have not peaked yet, but I give him some credit for that. Steve, let's kick around the debate and the economic messages in the debate. What did you guys think, Steve Moore? You start.
Well, I thought that Nikki Haley had a good debate. I thought here's the thing about Ron DeSantis. If you actually listen to what he said, he made a lot of sense, and he made a lot of really good points, in my opinion. But there's something about DeSantis that he's just not connecting with people. He doesn't smile. He doesn't have a sunny disposition. And then there was that one moment, I don't know if you guys recall, when Brett Baer asked, how many of you raise your hand would you? I forget even what the question. Would you pardon?
Would you back Trump? Yeah.
Yeah. And DeSantis looked around to see what he was. It was a really strange moment. So I love DeSantis's policies. I mean, what he's done in Florida has been amazing, but I just don't see him connecting with voters. And it didn't happen on what was it, Tuesday or Wednesday night. And really, I don't see any of the others taking out Trump. I just don't. Right,
let's take a break.
Junior varsity debate.
We'll get Liz back on this, and there's some more to talk about. Got to take a break. Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist. Steve Moore, he's got more money coming on right after this show and most of these same stations. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Larry Kudlow. Now back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're here talking money and politics with Liz Peek, Fox News contributor and syndicated columnist, and Steve Moore of FreedomWorks and Committee to Unleash Prosperity Hotline. And on most of these same stations, more money follows this show. More money. Liz, I didn't mean to cut you off. I want to give you a whack at it. Did they get an economic message out? I'm not sure they did.
No, I two things, Larry. I don't think they really focused on the economic question, which is a big deal, and particularly with the administration out there touting Bidenomics with a lot of inaccurate and untruthful information. And I also don't think they piled on Joe Biden. I mean, frankly, you know, I think they missed the boat in terms of going after each other instead of going after the common enemy. Joe Biden is the common enemy. He's a terrible president. He's hurting this country in lots of ways. And by the way, if you are a contender like Ron DeSantis trying to depose Donald Trump, which I agree with Steve is going to be incredibly hard to do, talk about electability. Talk about how it is essential to get Joe Biden out of the White House. Because, Larry, I'm not particularly extreme on things usually. I think 4 more years of this administration and this country's in trouble because a lot of the things they're doing are permanent. You know, messing with our energy infrastructure and power grids and all this stuff, if they do it wrong, and they are, it'll be permanently injurious. Letting 6 million people into the country, permanent impact on Americans across the board. These things have to stop. And by the way, the weaponization of the Justice Department is like number one. And it won't stop. So these guys needed to make the message that it is essential to get rid of Joe Biden, and they're the person to do it. And nobody even made that case, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree with you. That was a tough analysis you just gave, but I happen to agree. I don't think, by the by, they ripped into Bidenomics and the regulatory state and the spending. And as you say, the what they're going to do to the energy infrastructure, this stuff is crazy. I mean, we're kidding about no gas-powered cars and ceiling fans, but that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you give them 4 more years, they'll lock that stuff up. You know, Steve, they had a chance. I mean, there were snippets of it, but they didn't really make the Bidenomics case.
No, they didn't. And I, you know, may have seen in our hotline the day after the debate, we made the point that they didn't really talk about growth. You know,
right.
There wasn't enough about prosperity. You know, if I were coaching Ron DeSantis, you don't start out by saying America is in decline. You say that Biden is putting America in decline.
Right.
And there's a difference between those two things. And
Right. Look,
Reagan won because he faced a terrible president in Jimmy Carter, but he also provided this incredibly, optimistic view of America's future.
I know, and I didn't hear that optimism. I mean, I wanted, make America great. First guy to say that was Reagan, long time ago, 40 years ago. At the 1988 Republican convention, he's the one who said, make America great again. That was the first MAGA. And I didn't hear any MAGAs in this debate. And I was looking for MAGAs, and I was looking for what Art Laffer talks about. Art always says the GOP has to persuade the country that they will be the custodians of prosperity.
Yeah.
I didn't really hear that. Now,
Who's on the message right now, totally on message, is Trump.
Yes,
and
he
I love Trump. I love what he said the other day where he thanked all the people who supported him. And, I just love this new – he's not the grousing Trump that he was 9 months ago. And that's a good look for him.
Well, he was great. When I interviewed him, he was really good on the issues and he just was at the top of his game. Now, Steve, Art Laffer has threatened me with my life if I don't show up Monday at the Robert Kennedy Jr. Dinner.
Yeah.
I assume you're going to be there. I assume Liz is going to be there.
I hope so.
What's the story with Robert Kennedy? What's the story with this dinner, Steve Moore?
All right. Well, we have RFK coming, and I'm sitting next to my beautiful wife, Ann, who watched the whole thing that he did with Tucker, and I do like it. She said he was fantastic.
Ann Moore weighing in. Okay, good to hear. Is he going to cut taxes like his uncle?
Sorry?
Is he going to cut taxes like his uncle? That's the key point.
Well,
I'm
going to
ask him that.
Larry, you've got to get him on the tax cut message.
Yep. I mean, he's got to do that. Liz, are you going to come to this?
I haven't even actually heard about it. So,
I
heard about it a while ago, but haven't heard anything recently. Unfortunately, I'm not home in New York City yet, probably not. But I'm sad because I would really like to see this guy in person. I think he has a very interesting pitch. He's been, of course, dismissed by Biden people, but he's an interesting candidate, no question about it.
My line on this, Larry, is that he's right about 30% of the time, and that makes him a lot righter than almost every other Democrat.
That's not bad, Steve. Pretty good formula.
I agree. I think that's just about right. So a couple of people on this show have said that Biden is not going to be the candidate. If Biden's not going to be the candidate, who's going to be the candidate?
I'll take a stab at that. I think it totally depends when he gets out. If he gets out in the next month or so, you'll have a pretty robust primary, I guess. Hurry up. But we know that Newsom and Gretchen Whitmer, have had sort of shadow campaigns going on. They'll be ready to roll. If he's not out until February or March, I think it's either Kamala Harris or someone being brought in like Michelle Obama, who can hit the ground running, who has the entire money-raising apparatus in place, and who's very well-known. Michelle Obama obviously ticks all those boxes. So, you tell me, when's he getting out?
You know, you're the second person, I forget who the heck, but the Michelle Obama argument, that's very interesting, Steve Moore, because I got to say, Michelle Obama, that means Barack Obama. But basically, nothing would change, right? I mean, there'd still be Biden-esque policies because Biden just expanded on what Obama did.
Yeah, I will just simply say this, that I sure would rather run against Kamala Harris than Michelle Obama.
They might get rid of Kamala Harris, too. I mean, they can do anything they want at the convention. Anything they want. I think Charlie Hurt said this. I don't remember who said that. But in any event, the Michelle Obama argument, so you won't get any change. They're still going to be the far left party. They're still going to be the regulatory party, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll see about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. What else we got? SpaceX we covered. Liz, what's your column going to be about? You said you're really up in arms about SpaceX.
What are you going to say? Just that I think it's a preposterous persecution of this guy. And by the way, there was an article in the New York Times recently, too, that just struck me as completely ridiculous about how I think the headline was something like European partners concerned about Elon Musk's dominance of satellites. Well, OK, they're concerned. But on the other hand, he's the only game in town. And he was making satellite communications, which are completely essential to any kind of war operation, free. It was making them available. And then they jumped on him for saying, you know what, I can't really continue to afford this.
More money coming right up.